Mr. Ormond, you've conducted the Great Vienna and the Große Musikverein Saal in Vienna. What does it feel to... You've conducted every major orchestra in the world. What does it feel like to conduct something like the famed, the berühmte Wiener?
How does it feel? It feels wonderful. Because you are standing in front of old friends. I've known these people since I was a student. They grow older with me, so now they are past middle-aged. And I knew them when they were very young, and they just carry down the tradition from the generation before, from their teachers, then they take over, they become teachers, and their pupils take over. So the tradition goes right on. In that respect, there is only one orchestra in the world. That's the Vienna Philharmonic.
Mr. Ormond, you invited Rudolf Serkin, an old friend and colleague, to perform with you with the Vienna Philharmonic. How did this come about, and how long has it been since Serkin performed with the Wiener?
He wasn't there throughout the war, as you know, and he hasn't gone back for a long time. And one day, they asked me, you know Serkin, I said, of course, he's my, and I'm not exaggerating, he's my dearest friend. And I said, I know him very well. Would you ask him to come? He hasn't replied to our invitation. But that's not unusual. He never replies himself. He just doesn't write letters. But I said one day to him, would you play in Vienna? They want you badly. He said to me, would you conduct for me? I said, would I? And how? And he gave me his hand, and I immediately notified the Vienna Philharmonic to ask him to do a Mozart concerto.
Did they ask for the Mozart, or was that his suggestion?
He knows all the concerti,
yes.
All Mozart concerti. In fact, he has a fantastic repertoire. Even though many people think he only plays Brahms and Beethoven, it's not true at all. He has a tremendous repertoire.
You know, we were talking about the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, which you knew before the war. I wonder whether the complexion of the orchestra,
I knew
the
it
profile has changed.
As a child, I used to go to their concerts.
As you recall, having heard it before and hearing it today.
But in those days, that was the greatest orchestra that I had ever heard.
Is it the same instrument? You know, is it the same orchestra?
It is the same orchestra. It's the same orchestra, very much the same orchestra.
Same pride.
Children children and grandchildren of the same people I have heard when I was a child. But the spirit is the same, and they carried on a tradition all the way through. That's why a conductor has to have a tremendous personality and ability to convince them that they have to play a certain phrase or work their way, in spite of the fact that they have played it with other famous, perhaps even more famous conductors, a different way. The Vienna Philharmonic prides itself that they choose their own conductors. Conductors is plural because they usually ask each conductor to conduct one concert. They have 12 each year. Actually, 11. The 12th one is the Nicolai concert. He's the founder of the Vienna Philharmonic, and they usually play the Beethoven 9th Symphony. So 11 concerts in a season are really not very much by our standard. And I often suggested to them, why don't they increase it? But they just have such schedule, they have operas every day, sometimes two in one day, that they couldn't, they have the academy where they are teaching and have private pupils and recordings galore. I mean, they have probably every day a 5-hour recording session. How they can manage doing all of that, it's almost impossible to understand. But these concerts are actually repeated in a very strange way. You get 3 rehearsals, sometimes with great difficulties. You get a 4th one if you play a novelty, which is new to the orchestra. But the last rehearsal is really not a rehearsal. It's called a dress rehearsal, and the audience pays. That Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock, and the regular concerts are Sunday morning after church at 11 o'clock. But they are sold out for years in advance. Nobody can get in.
Would it disturb you here at home if you had an audience for a dress rehearsal?
Well, actually, we have to realize that they call a dress rehearsal. It's really a concert. I may add, the performers don't get paid for it.
When they are examined in relation to European orchestras, American orchestras seem to have developed an orchestral sound that has a European background. Do you think this is caused by the European training of conductors like yourself?
Yeah. I'm really an American conductor. Not because I consider myself so, but I'm an American-trained conductor. I was a European-trained violinist when I came over.
Yes.
But my conductorial education goes back to Furtwängler, Mengelberg, Toscanini, who was my greatest god in music and still is.
Yeah.
And all these great conductors, all of them European, but coming over and allowing me, giving me the opportunity to watch them rehearse. And I've learned a great deal from them. So I really am an American conductor. But I know the European conductors because many of them I bring over every year. We have the greatest influx of European conductors of any orchestra in America. But I want the Americans, especially Philadelphians, to hear the finest of them all. And they are magnificent, not only, of course, in our country, but they are magnificent in Europe, too. And it never fails when they give great compliments. And as they're surprised how quickly our orchestras, if I may add, the Philadelphia Orchestra, yeah, fulfills their wishes. Because we don't have stars in our orchestra. We are all musicians, all colleagues. We work for one cause. Now, the Vienna Philharmonic is very much the same way. And they are a few stars, probably in every orchestra, but they don't call themselves. Everybody knows they are, and then we just forget about that. We don't talk about that.
How many concertmasters does the Vienna have?
Well, that's a very good question.
Since we're talking about stars.
Yes, the Vienna Philharmonic has four first concertmasters. Now, if Mr. Boskovsky, who is the first concertmaster, plays a particular concert, I may add, he's doing the conductor a great favor. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have to if he doesn't want to. Then the second first concertmaster sits next to him, the third first concertmaster sits next to him, and the fourth first concertmaster sits at the second stand inside. Now, if they have liked the conductor or respect him, they have four first concertmasters playing there. In one concert, which is exactly the same as if my first two stands would be playing, and they were called first, second, and third, and fourth first concertmaster. But they love titles in Europe. And
I saw a clipping in Time magazine which sounded a bit complacent, and so I ask you, with that preface, just what you feel about this statement. One of the concertmasters, I don't know if it was first, second, third, or fourth, said, our grandfathers here in Vienna played for Beethoven and Brahms, and they passed this knowledge on to us, and so we know how they should be played. I thought that sounded a bit complacent, if I may repeat that word, a bit smug.
Well, how can
this
do
be passed down from one generation to another?
I don't see how. They could probably say how Beethoven wanted the phrase. Don't forget that Beethoven, after he passed 30, he was completely deaf.
Yes.
So he was unable to even tell them, other than with his eyes, what he wanted and how he wanted.
But he insisted on conducting anyway, didn't he?
Oh, yes. And he was a fantastic conductor in his day.
Until the deafness overtook him.
Even after that, he conducted.
Was he?
Oh, yes, he conducted the Ninth Symphony.
Yes, I've read, I think, particularly in The Little Man from the New York Times, with Schoenberg, writing in his book on the great conductors. I think he talks about the fact that Beethoven was finally asked to leave the podium.
That's right.
Because the musicians simply could not follow him.
That's right. That's right.
It's tragic.
It is the greatest tragedy. And not to get away from Beethoven, who was one of the great conductors of all times. Furtwängler, who was one of the great interpreters of Beethoven and one of the great conductors in the history of music, became deaf in his middle 60s. And that ended his life when he realized that he cannot hear what he conducts. He can see, but cannot hear what he conducts. He was unable to balance his orchestra, balance the stage above him, and the orchestra with the soloist and chorus. He had to give it up, and that ended his life. Shortly after that, he passed away.
You're playing Beethoven on this concert, and since we've talked about Beethoven as a conductor, how would Mozart as a conductor, he obviously was an excellent conductor, how would the Vienna Philharmonic have received him as a craftsman, as a conductor?
It's impossible to tell. You mean now?
in this day and age, had he lived today, I understand that at one point, I think he was doing Die Zauberflöte, and someone in the audience who was a composer came up and kissed his hand because he conducted so magnificently.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Now, by today's standards, did it?
Oh, yes.
By today, has anyone ever kissed your hand while you were conducting?
I'm not a Beethoven.
But there's so many beautiful ladies on stage with you singing arias at times.
If it did happen, I wouldn't tell you.
You've always been a gentleman.
I would be terribly unmodest.
It's very gallant of you.
But time and again, I saw people kissing Toscanini's hand. Many times after the performance, either when he conducted a symphony orchestra, the New York Philharmonic, or the Vienna Philharmonic. I was there many times when he conducted them, and people kissed his hand. And the Philadelphia Orchestra, too.
How does one react to that kind of emotion?
Well, he being a European, very European in every way, and Italian besides, he accepted it. I've seen it many times. In fact, I must confess, I once kissed his hand myself.
Did you?
And he accepted it.
Do you recall where it was?
In Philadelphia. The first time he conducted our orchestra, I was so touched and so carried away. I went back. I had no desire to do, no thought of it.
Yes.
When I saw this great man in front of me, he put his hand out. He says, "You have a great orchestra." And I grabbed it without realizing it. I kissed it. He accepted it without a word.
It's marvelous.
And put his hand on my hand. He wanted to tell me that he liked my orchestra.
I think that's beautiful. We were talking about fears of conductor, for example, Beethoven becoming deaf. What are the other fears a conductor has? There must be constant feelings of insecurity. Health, of course.
Insecurity. If a conductor, and it applies to other instrumentalists and vocalists, if they're away for a while, let's say 6 months or so, from their craft, from their orchestra, from their stage, they become very insecure. I don't know if I'm indiscreet when I say that, since Toscanini was probably the greatest conductor in the history of music. He told me on several occasions that when he faced an orchestra for the first time, or his own orchestra after a summer's vacation, he couldn't sleep at night for several nights in fear that maybe they take over and they will run him and boss him rather than he running them. And finally, he says, "I get so nervous, so I have to rush on the stage and start conducting without saying anything. I want to prove to myself." And he had to prove to himself that he is the conductor of the orchestra. And I know that feeling so well, especially when I return after an operation that I've had, and I was out for several months. It's a terrible feeling that, not that in my case in the orchestra, these are different days than in Toscanini's time. We are colleagues, we are friends, we are family. So I wasn't afraid that they will try to fight me. In fact, they were giving me anything I asked for, even with hardly moving my operated on arm. But I had that fear. Now, will they accept me? Will they realize? Will I still think that I'm good and able to lead them? It's a terrible thought and terrible feeling that comes to a performer's mind and a conductor's mind especially.
How soon do you feel how much in control you are of an orchestra? Let's
after
assume.
The second measure.
Is that fast?
After the second measure, I size them up.
Yes.
And they size me up after the fourth measure.
What about the audience when you finally play the concert? How but quickly do you realize how...
Oh, you feel it behind you constantly as you stand there. You feel, are they with me or are they not? You feel it. There's something in the air, some electricity in the air that gives you that feeling, whether you realize it or not. Of course, you must realize it, that they are with you.
How would you feel about an American orchestra electing its own conductor, a la Vienna?
Well, the situation couldn't happen in this country because it would be like the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra, I'm just mentioning because that's our greatest opera company. Metropolitan Opera Orchestra would create a philharmonic of the Metropolitan Opera. I don't know what they would call it, because there is a New York Philharmonic. There's an American symphony in New York. So it can. But in a similar case, they could probably do that. But since there is no such a thing, there is a board of directors who picks, after very carefully considering all the available talent, picks the conductor. the guest conductor and the music director. So they're most careful about picking the right one. And one of the questions that come up in these at these meetings, which I've heard many times, how would he get along with the orchestra? And how would the orchestra personnel get along with him? Being great or good or outstanding is not enough. That's not enough. You must be able to work together with your colleagues.
Is that a sad commentary on our times, that it becomes necessary to be a, quote, good sport?
No.
To be able to get along with other people?
No, not at all.
I don't know how Artur Nikisch would have handled this or any of the people around the turn of the century, but I'm sure no one ever asked them.
I only saw Nikisch when I was a very young boy once at a festival concert. I don't know how he treated his orchestra, but I do know how Toscanini did, which was not necessarily a very pleasant way of treating an orchestra. He couldn't control himself. As Toscanini today, we many times talk about it. A Toscanini today, with his genius, probably wouldn't be able to have any real contact with the orchestra because it only takes one person to get up.
But 15 years have turned the tide. 15 years ago, he did do it.
There were complaints. He left the stage many times for rehearsals because he got mad at the person. Because he didn't realize that he's talking to another human person, a human being, who is also great on his instrument. He's not a Toscanini. But on his instrument, he might be just as great as Toscanini was. And he said something to him that didn't please the man. And he hurt the man. Because he tried his best. And he knew he did his best. Now, that wouldn't work. I don't think it would work, even for Toscanini, had he lived today. But I think he was so great that even today, they would forgive him. I think he was such a great man.
Mr. Ormond, you grew up in Europe, in Hungary. You went to school in Hungary. You perfected your lessons. The violin was your instrument.
Yes.
You studied this very strenuously there. What were your dreams as a boy? Was America somewhere in the background of these dreams?
Oh, yes.
Always?
Oh, yes.
At what age did it begin?
14. I was 14 years old when we started to talk, to be taught world history.
Yes.
And somehow, at the back of my mind, having grown up in a country like Hungary, I felt that we were not having any democracy, the freedom of speech, freedom of thought, and I felt freedom of religion. It was not possible there. So I felt that someday I'd like to come to this country, go to America, where there are four freedoms about which we learn so much. And I had hoped to go to America. I didn't know how and when and how I would do it. But I had hoped and always felt like, at heart, I was an American at 14. And when I graduated from school, I made every effort to come to this country. Then when I graduated, I went to live in Vienna. And I played a lot of concerts there and around there in Germany. Recitals, yes. And with the symphony orchestra. I played with the Vienna Philharmonic also. But of course, I was a very unknown. As a matter of fact, I only played once, and I called myself the Tonkünstler Orchestra, because I was too unknown to be playing with the Vienna Philharmonic.
I have a note here somewhere from someone. It's marked nostalgia, from someone who knew I'd be talking with you, who wanted to hear something about, perhaps a few anecdotes about your days in Vienna, years ago. Can one recall those without too much effort?
Anecdotes in Vienna?
Yes, just some of your remembrances of the early days in that great city.
Oh, of the city?
Yes.
Well, this was an inspiration. You know, when you grew up in Budapest, as I have, which was the capital of Hungary and, so to speak, of the East at the time, I thought I was really in a great city, in a big city, until I moved to Vienna. Then I realized that it's another world. It's really the world of culture. Wherever you turn, there was history, culture, everything. You can't go anywhere in Vienna, in a city, where there are no houses next to each other, where this or that great poet, great architect, great painter, great composer, great writer lived or died, or lived from here to this, these number of years. Even if it was only 2 years, he lived so and so. There is one anecdote that I can tell that is very well known. There was a very, shall I say, famous or infamous music critic named Hanslick in Vienna. Depends on whether he wrote well or badly about you. He wrote badly most of the time. But for some reason, he took great liking to Brahms. And they were walking right behind the Karlskirche, the Karl's church, near the Musikvereinsaal, just where we all played, about a block away. And Hanslick suddenly turned over to Brahms with some false modesty. He said, "This is the house where I was born, Herr Professor." And Brahms, who knew how much hated this Hanslick was, looked up to his, "Very interesting. I could just see after you die the sign on the door." He says, "Yes, what will it say?" He says, "For rent." This is known, very well known.
I've not heard
But that. I mean, these are the things. Viennese are always ready to cut somebody's throat with a smile.
With a smile?
With a smile. Always with a smile. But they don't like him. Of course, if they like him, they'll give him everything.
Yes. At the heart of the city, there is this great orchestra, which everybody is always aware of. This
oh, yes.
great cognizance.
Oh, yes. Very much. In fact, both orchestras are there.
I sometimes wonder whether we overdo it in America in thinking of the Viennese as being musical. Every Wiener is a great lover of good music.
What they have, and what we unfortunately don't have, when you walk on the street next to any of those houses, and many of them 200 years old, and the janitor always has his apartment below the first main floor, and only has
what is he called? He's the concierge.
Housemeister.
Housemeister.
Yes. And he has a little window. That's his only contact with the outside world.
He's a great ankle man.
Yes. You can walk by any of those open windows, and you always will hear somebody practice the violin, the piano, or singing. Something going on that's musical, which unfortunately we don't have in this country. And that's what I'm hoping for before I die.
More housemaster.
Not more housemeisters. We have enough of housemeisters. But we don't have the children's interest in music, in learning classical music. They spend too much time playing football and baseball. I'm all for it. But
in its
place. Moderation.
Yes.
In its place, in its time.
Mr. Ormandy, we talk in terms of Beethoven and Brahms and Mozart. I wonder how Vienna would take to young composers. For instance, I recall a story in the New York Times about your playing one of the Walton symphonies back in the middle 30s, and 200 precious ladies walked out of the academy of a Friday afternoon because they were impatient with a new piece.
The same Walton symphony is going to be performed this year by Mr. Previn. The same one. It hasn't been played since. And this is 34 years ago.
Yes.
I never told him, by the way, that I walked out. He might have changed
his
program.
We'll tear up those reviews. The reviews were good, by the way. They were excellent.
Yes.
They gave you a great deal of credit for having the courage
for having
to play Walton
courage.
At the time.
Yes.
But while 200 ladies walked out, some others kind of tittered during
it may have been a little more than that.
Are you aware of this when people walk out?
No. Thank God I don't see what goes on behind me. That's what I always say. I don't care if they walk out. I don't care. I don't see it. But the musicians see it. Of course, they tell me afterwards. You know what Mrs. Stokowski did? When he found out they walked out on him, he turned around, he says, "Now we are going to play it again. But those who don't want to hear it, please leave right away." Those narrow-minded people.
It's beautiful.
Oh, he gave it to them.
You sometimes harbor the fear that perhaps the young people are not as enthusiastic about good music as the preceding generation was?
Here? No, the each generation is going forward. I found out very happily and terribly proud of it. When I see these young people, 18, 19, 20 years old, a very critical age when nothing is good, you know, when they know everything better than anybody else, they come to you with records after the concerts. But I don't mean, you know, we tour an awful lot with our orchestra, so I find this all the time. They come to you backstage with 5, 6 records, and usually a record of the symphony or a symphonic poem you played that day, that night, and say to me, "Mr. Ormandy, the second movement of the symphony, it's either Frank or the Beethoven Fifth or whatever it is," he says to me, You played a little slower tonight. Why? So here I use the Brahms story. When somebody asked Brahms why he didn't put metronomic markings to his four symphonies. And he grabbed this man's hand and puts his hand, his thumb over here. He says, tell me, can you put metronomic markings to your pulse, which changes every second?
I said, how
do I know how I recorded it? 10 years ago, 5 years ago. Yesterday, I don't know how I played it. I'm sure I didn't play it the same way. We are not machines. We are made of blood and flesh. We're human beings.
Thank you, Mr. Armandale.